From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobel Prize-winning game theorist John Nash, best known as the subject of the book and film A Beautiful Mind, died this week in a car crash with his wife, Alicia. Nash went from being a young, brilliant economist at Princeton to someone deeply altered by schizophrenia. His 1994 Nobel Prize and a book and film turned him into a worldwide celebrity. This hour on Point, remembering A Beautiful Mind. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you take from the story of John Nash's life, his genius, his schizophrenia, his game theory? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Beautiful Mind, 2001 film, a lot of Academy Awards. Russell Crowe was there, Jennifer Connelly as John Nash and his wife Alicia. Here's a bit where Nash, played by Russell Crowe, is invited to the Pentagon to break a code no one else had succeeded in breaking. He finds a pattern in the numbers.
46-13-08-67-46-90. Starkey Corners, Maine. 48-03-01-91-26-35. Prairie Portage, Minnesota. These are latitudes and longitudes. There are at least 10 others. They appear to be routing orders across the border into the U.S.
Extraordinary. Gentlemen, we need to move on this.
Genius, genius. That would have been the late 40s or early 1950s. Here in 1994, the real thing. John Nash being awarded the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences for his work on non-cooperative games theory.
Dr. John Nash, your analysis of equilibrium non-cooperative games and all your other contributions to game theory have had a profound effect on the way economic theory has developed in the last two decades. It's an honor and privilege for me to convey to all of you, on the behalf of the Royal Academy of Sciences, our warmest congratulations. I now ask you to receive your prizes from the hand of His Majesty the King.
And those two clips barely began to tell the story of all that happened in between, but it has been told. Joining me now from Tarrytown, New York, Sylvia Nasser, author of A Beautiful Mind. It won the 1998 National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography, was turned into the 2001 Academy Award-winning film A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe as John Nash, Jennifer Connelly as Alicia Nash. Sylvia Nasser is professor of business journalism at Columbia University these days, former economics correspondent for the New York Times. Sylvia Nasser, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What happened? He and his wife last weekend had been in Norway receiving yet another prize. They came back, came into the airport, and it's everyone's nightmare. Were they on their way home in this taxi cab? What happened?
That's right. John Nash was one of the greatest mathematicians of the second half of the century, and although he was very pleased to have gotten a Nobel in economics, he was, I think, maybe even as or more pleased to get this recognition from the mathematics community. And they were on their way back from Norway. Their regular driver, it was totally random. Their regular driver, for some reason, didn't show up or maybe wasn't available. They took a cab and then they died in a completely arbitrary and pointless way. It shouldn't have ended that way.
The driver lost control of the taxi cab on the New Jersey Turnpike.
That's right.
4:30 in the afternoon.
They weren't wearing seatbelts. I suspect probably because there were no functional seatbelts in the back. I don't know. They were extraordinarily careful about stuff like that. And they were thrown from the car and killed right away.
John Nash, 86, his wife, Alicia, 82, thrown from the car. Taxi driver taken to the hospital, but he seems all right now. A beautiful mind does not protect one from that kind of physical violence.
Just a twist of fate.
Yeah, just unbelievable. After that long and beautiful life, and the two of them together remind us, people will remember that the relationship got difficult as his schizophrenia set in. But their relationship was beautiful, too, in how even after they divorced for a time, she, in many ways, she stuck with him, Sylvia.
That's right. At a certain point, maybe 5 years after their divorce, when he had been ill for about 10 years with paranoid schizophrenia, he was incarcerated in a mental hospital in Virginia, and he begged her to take him in and to protect him from other involuntary hospitalizations. And she agreed to do that. So for the next, 25 years, when he was still really ill, she provided a home and a family for him. They lived together with their son, Johnny, and, you know, it was for richer, for poorer.
Of course.
It was really that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Richer, poorer, sickness and in health. Jennifer Connelly played her in the movie. Very beautiful. But I'm looking at early photographs here of Alicia. Looking at one here where they were in Paris in 1960. Stunning beauty herself, John Nash's wife, Alicia.
Yes. She looked like a young Elizabeth Taylor. I just remember talking to Paul Samuelson when he was almost 90 years old. And he was reminiscing about Nash at MIT when Nash was a young professor there. And he remembered Alicia, and what he remembered about her was that she was a physics major and that she was extraordinarily beautiful. So she was.
They met at MIT. She was kind of Costa Rican aristocracy there, and he was the very, very, very bright young chap.
That's right. She had, her father was a scientist, and she had an interest in science. She had some dreams of being another Madame Curie, but when she ran into John Nash, who was her professor, her goal became to marry this handsome, if eccentric, but beautifully dressed and with wonderful Southern manners, this mathematical rock star, and that's what she did. And very shortly after they married, of course, he became ill, and that whole 30-year nightmare of paranoid schizophrenia began. And from at the beginning, she was so brave and so stalwart. She organized a tremendous amount of support from the mathematical community. She never hid his illness. Mm-hmm. She just wanted him to not lose touch with the intellectual stimulus and comradeship of other mathematicians. And yes.
Of course, their son, Johnny, who you mentioned, also came to suffer from schizophrenia, a big deal in his parents' life ultimately. Sylvia Nasser, you've written so beautifully in A Beautiful Mind and Beyond about John Nash. You describe him as one of those rare people, rare in so many ways, but not least among them in that he was given a kind of third chapter in his life. Take us through those chapters.
Yes, I was going to say that there's so many stories in literature about a meteoric rise, which he certainly had. He came to Princeton at 19. He was already a star in mathematics. He was introduced as, with a one-line letter of recommendation, this man is a genius. And from there until he was his 30th birthday, he did one extraordinary piece of work after the other. And the game theory, what he won the Nobel Prize for, that was his 26-page PhD dissertation written at age 21 and regarded by mathematicians as his juvenilia, quote, the most trivial thing he ever did. I mean, economists don't think that, but he went on to do very brilliant foundational work in disparate areas of pure mathematics, geometry, and partial differential equations, work that has had a major impact on those fields. So at 30, he had seemed to have everything. He was had a brilliant career ahead of him. He was already famous within the world of mathematics. He had won the heart of a beautiful woman. He had a baby, his first son on the way. And then his beautiful mind betrayed him, and within, you know, in a short period of time, he was talking about aliens from outer space, wanting him to save the world. He was offering his PhD students intergalactic driver's licenses and offering them seats on world government. So instead of the beautiful, logical, and extremely original work that preoccupied him in his 20s, he did numerology and had the kinds of delusions that we associate with schizophrenia. He thought he was Jesus Christ and the Emperor of Antarctica, all kinds of things. And over the years, as his early ideas became more and more influential in fields that were really so far apart that nobody associated the Nash of the Nash embedding theorem with the Nash of the Nash equilibrium in game theory, as his ideas became more and more influential, he sank ever deeper into poverty and obscurity. And students around Princeton knew him as the ghost of Fine Hall.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Mr. Beautiful Mind, game theory genius, John Nash, mathematician, economist, Nobel Prize winner, schizophrenic, dead this week at 86 with his wife Alicia in a taxi crash on the New Jersey Turnpike. We're looking at the life of his mind. Sylvia Nasser is with us, author of A Beautiful Mind. The book won the 1998 National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography, became the basis for the Academy Award-winning movie A Beautiful Mind. She joins us from Tarrytown, New York today. We're going to turn our microphones to Stockholm, Sweden as well in just a moment here. Here's a bit from the 2001 film A Beautiful Mind. John Nash, played by Russell Crowe, at a bar with friends. They all have their eyes on a blonde woman who is at the bar with her girlfriends. Nash's friends are talking about the economist Adam Smith and how every man should look out for his own interests. Nash, in the movie, has a kind of epiphany.
If we all go for the blonde, we block each other. Not a single one of us is going to get her. So then we go for her friends. But they will all give us the cold shoulder because nobody likes to be second choice. What if no one goes for the blonde? We don't get in each other's way, and we don't insult the other girls. It's the only way we win.
The only way we win, and thus Hollywood and Ron Howard walk us into game theory in the film A Beautiful Mind. Here, The Real Thing, 2002 interview with 60 Minutes' Mike Wallace. Wallace asked John Nash if he had heard aliens in his head speaking to him.
When I began to hear voices, I thought of the voices as from something of that sort.
Mm-hmm. What would they say to you?
Well, you see, it's really my subconscious talking.
Sylvia Nasser wrote the book, A Beautiful Mind. She's with us from Tarrytown, New York. Listeners writing in, Christian writes to us, Nash's story and his solution concept in game theory were what got me first interested in economics. Without it, I would not have discovered the fascinating world of oligopolies, interest rate pressures, and how we, as irrational human beings, make decisions. Whole fields deeply informed and illuminated by the game theory work of John Nash. Sylvia Nasser, please stand by there in Tarrytown, New York. With us right now from Stockholm, Sweden, is Jürgen Wable, professor of economics at the Stockholm School of Economics. He first met John Nash 25 years ago at Princeton. From 2005 to 2007, he was chairman of the Economics Prize Committee of the Royal Academy, Swedish Academy in Sciences. They proposed the winners of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. He's author of Evolutionary Game Theory. Jörgen Weibel in Stockholm, Sweden, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on this program.
We want to talk with you about game theory, but take us back to the first time you met John Nash. He was at Princeton. He had been for years kind of lost in the schizophrenia. How was he when you met him, Jörgen, and why were you there?
Yes, John Nash was kind of lost. Some people thought he was no longer alive. He was not active since 1958, really, and I was at Princeton, invited by the university to be a visiting professor there to teach game theory, the work of John Nash, and also people have followed him. So there was a huge development in that area, and that was my job, so I was there. Then, since I was teaching this, and I knew Professor Harold Kuhn, professor of mathematics and economics, a longtime friend of John Nash, and also a game theorist himself, I asked, could it might possibly meet John Nash? And he said, of course. So he suggested then that I invite him for lunch. So Kuhn then, you know, contacted his friend John Nash, who lived somewhere nearby, but was not employed at the time at the university. And then I invited him for lunch. So we met then in May 1990. So that's 25 years ago. And I remember vividly this meeting, of course, because he was an icon. You know, it's like meeting somebody you have heard about or read about in books.
Yeah.
You know, you think,
yes,
a giant. And there he was, very humble and nervous and insecure, and greeted me nervously and said, you know, can I go in here? I'm not faculty, because I had invited him into the faculty club of Princeton University.
Yeah,
and I felt so sad when I heard that he felt that way. You know, one of the greatest scientists, and that he shouldn't feel, you know, entitled to enter there. So I said, of course, let's go in and have lunch. So we went in there together then with my friend and colleague then at Princeton, Professor Kaushik Basu, who is now the chief economist of the World Bank, and we were friends and working together on game theory. So we had sat down to have lunch, and then we started the conversation, and there was no talk about things like in the movie. There is a scene there with somebody invite coming from Sweden to invite him for tea, but that was not the situation. I was there as faculty, and we had a nice lunch. He was a little bit eccentric and had forgotten many things, but on the whole, I think he was, you know, it was a coherent and nice conversation. We talked about, I asked him, you know, how was it that you came to your ideas? They were so creative and so original, and we talked a little bit. He didn't say too much. But he was not, I wouldn't say I felt that he was mentally ill or anything like that.
In the film, you are portrayed there as one of the characters in the film visiting, kind of sent out from Stockholm in the film version, to see they're thinking about giving this man a Nobel Prize, and is he up to it? Here's Nash's response in the film.
I am crazy. I take the new medications. I still see things that are not here. I just choose not to acknowledge them. Like a diet of the mind, I choose not to indulge certain appetites.
Russell Crowe, playing John Nash in the film A Beautiful Mind. Sylvia Nasser, ultimately that Nobel Prize would come. How important was that in turning John Nash's life around? Was the prize part of what pulled him up out of his schizophrenia, or was he already ascending?
Tom, I think you're absolutely right. I think that recognition completed the cure. He aged out of it, as out of schizophrenia, as a very small minority of people with the illness do, without any treatment. He never was treated after 1970. He also learned to manage his symptoms. That is true, the prize, and of course, Alicia giving him a home to and a light to come back to, was very, very important in his recovery. Somebody described it as somehow he just slowly woke up, and these were, you know, these were the reasons why.
he was late to go into schizophrenia. I mean, he, as you said earlier, until he was 30, he was doing quite remarkable work. Very often it's going to hit and affect people much earlier than that. And here he comes back out. As Jürgen Wable, our guest with us in Stockholm today, sat down with him, John Nash, for lunch at the Faculty Club 25 years ago. Lots of listeners with questions and comments for the two of you, Jürgen Wable and Sylvia Nasser. Camille in Charleston, South Carolina. Thank you for calling, Camille. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And I am curious as to Dr. Nash's decision to, because it was his decision, he was able to make it, to no longer have medication, and if that, we in America have a word for eccentricities, which is usually mental illness at this point. However, other cultures assign it as a possible spiritual or metaphysical attack. And as Dr. Nash's work in game theory, I believe, had a very spiritual aspect to it in terms of going for the good of the entirety of everyone. If either of you would speak to either of those points, that would be great. Thank you.
Camille, thank you so much. Sylvia, I'll come first to you. There's kind of grand theory of John Nash encompassing his schizophrenia and a sort of spiritual rebirth, maybe, to health and game theory. Can you see it, Sylvia?
Well, I hear what you're saying, but I have to disagree. Schizophrenia destroyed his creativity. It's true that many great thinkers and artists have had a quote touch of madness, but a major mental illness, whether it's schizophrenia or bipolar illness, destroys creativity, and that's what you saw in Nash's life, because after his 20s, he was no longer able to have those original thoughts and work on things that were so meaningful to other people. He did these crazy calculations that were numerological. He had a real illness, and it was a tragedy, not uplifting.
It was Nash talking with PBS in 2002 in the documentary A Brilliant Madness.
A delusional state of mind is like living a dream. Well, I knew where I was. I was there in observation, but I was able to think that I was like a victim of a conspiracy.
The real John Nash. Jürgen Wable in Stockholm. Take us to game theory. We'll have listeners who are very expert in it. It has spread into so many fields of economics and strategy and corporate competition and nuclear negotiation and well beyond. John Nash did not come up with game theory, but he was celebrated for the advances that he brought to it. Can you describe for us, in layman's terms, if however you like, what it was that Nash brought to game theory?
Well, he actually unleashed whole agenda, a very wide agenda, from something that existed. It was, I would mention, John von Neumann,
yes,
who was then at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton at mm-hmm. the time when John Nash came there, who had, I would say, founded modern game theory. But von Neumann's work was focused on the special case of two parties with absolutely opposite interests, like in a war or a fight or playing chess. One mm-hmm. win is the other one's loss.
Mm-hmm.
And then von Neumann suggested one can think of this as a mathematical object, and one could ask if it is possible that every such game has a solution, and what we should mean by a solution. So a solution should then be something which would be, for one party, the best that party could do against the other, mm-hmm. and for the other party, the best that could do against the first party. And that is a very difficult question. It had been approached earlier by mathematician Emile Borel in France in the early 20s, who gave up, finding it probably not possible. Von Neumann didn't know about it when he did his first work in 1927. So he, being a very creative mind also, he conjured up a proof that in any finite game with two players who have opposite interests, like a zero-sum game, there always exists a solution. that is, a strategy for each of them which will be optimal for each of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this was for any finite game, so it could be no matter how complex. So it could be a game taking place over many days with new information coming in, and some parties might know something that others wouldn't know, and so on. So it's a very complex situation. We can think of chess. You know, when you play chess, mm-hmm. at yes. every moment you have the pieces, you have this chessboard in front of you, and then what is your next move? The number of combinations is astronomical. So he said, even if it's astronomical but finite, there will exist at least one solution. Now, that means that that was a fantastic achievement, but the applications were limited then to pure conflict. And as we know, most interactions in human life and also in biology and so on mm-hmm. is not only pure conflict. There are elements of cooperation and coordination and so forth.
Even when they're not conscious, I suppose, even when they're not deliberate.
Absolutely. So we can even go to biology. There could be benefits to say, animals or plants, which they are not at all conscious of course, but they could try out different things, and they could come up with an equilibrium just by trial and error and survival of the fittest. So that is true. So it doesn't have to be conscious. And John Nash was actually aware when he wrote his thesis, as young as he was, that one could think of two interpretations of his way of doing these things, namely one which is conscious and very rational, and that's how economists like to think about it,
mm-hmm.
and another which doesn't require much consciousness at all, more or less trial and error, and abandoning bad ideas. So if we go back now to von Neumann, and we had only two parties with opposite interests, imagine interactions with any number of parties. Maybe there are a dozen of firms in an industry.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have some interest in having a joined, standard of, for example, operative system of telephones or computers and so forth, right? Some things are common interests and some are conflicting.
Mm-hmm.
And the number is not two, it's not zero sum, how to deal with that? Von Neumann had suggested something together with economist Morgenstern, which was a way of looking at coalition formation among parties, and that was a very complicated machinery which didn't produce the results that it was hoped to give.
Mm-hmm.
Young John Nash walked around then, you could say, on campus and just conjured up this brilliant, very clean and pure idea of thinking of any number of parties interacting. And they can have any number of strategies available to them, any finite number. And they may have interest in common or not. They can be, one can be jealous of the other, one can be spiteful, mm-hmm. one can be altruistic, one can want to save the world. Doesn't matter. No matter what their goal functions are, he could prove there exists a solution, and then he had to generalize an idea of a solution from two people who are fighting against each other, where one's win is the other one's loss, right? So he then conjured up a beautiful definition of a solution, which we call Nash equilibrium. And then he proved every game has at least one such. He did this on a one-page article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the United States in 1950.
Yeah. So, Sylvia Nasser, we have an image of John Nash at Princeton, at MIT as well, I think, walking into classrooms, filling blackboards with mathematical formula. Was all of this reducible in mathematics or expressible in mathematic formulae?
Yes. He was a mathematician, so he wanted to express himself. He was in the habit of expressing himself in a very precise way. Mathematics is just a language, but it's a very precise language, and it's also a language that anyone around the globe who is trained in mathematics can understand. You don't have to translate it. So. Yes, he was a mathematician, and he wanted to express himself very precisely, and he wanted to prove something. He didn't want to just speculate about something. He wanted to prove an absolute truth, and that is what he did over and over again.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Mr. Beautiful Mind, game theory genius John Nash, mathematician, economist, Nobel Prize winner, schizophrenic, died this week at 86 with his also brilliant wife, Alicia, in a taxi crash on the New Jersey Turnpike, returning home from Norway, where he had been lauded yet again with another award in mathematics. 86 years old, looking at the life of his mind, and right beside him, the life of the woman who was such a partner in that life in so many ways, intellectual and much more. Sylvia Nasser is with us. She wrote the book, A Beautiful Mind. She joins us today from Tarrytown, New York. It was the basis for the Academy Award-winning film of the same name. Jörgen Weibel joins us from Stockholm, Sweden. He's professor of economics at Stockholm School of Economics. First met John Nash 25 years ago, before the Nobel Prize, at Princeton. He had organized a game theory conference in Oxford for next month, June. John Nash was scheduled to attend. Instead, at that conference, our guest, Jörgen Weibel, will organize a memorial for John Nash. George is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. George, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Can we talk about John? My parents went to the same high school as John Nash in Bluefield, West Virginia, which is a beautiful small town in the Blue Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
I guess antithesis of a place you'd expect someone with his intellect to grow up. But it was interesting. My father told me that he was so far ahead of his professors in high school that at the time he graduated, the school advised his parents that John Nash was not college material. Which is rather amusing, of course.
Yeah.
Knowing what we do now, but
yes, but maybe his intellect would have been a lot to handle in high school in Bluefield, West Virginia, or anywhere else, George.
Well, that's my point. Yeah, he was just so far ahead of his professors, even in advanced levels of math. He was not in the same class as my father, but in the same high school, Beaver High.
George, I'm so grateful for your call. Sylvia Nasser, one of the things among many that I love about this show is that people like George there in Kentucky call with direct knowledge. His parents went to school with John Nash in West Virginia. I'm sure you know the story of his difficulty in completing ordinary sort of K-12 schoolwork, but then how did he catapult directly into the heights of Princeton and a PhD by the time he was barely into his 20s?
Well, when he was an undergraduate at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh,
first, mm-hmm.
his genius was recognized, and because he was already doing original research having original insights at age 19, and one of his professors there wrote him a letter of recommendation. It was the shortest one that Princeton probably ever got. All it said was, "This man is a genius." So,
and the recognition came, and the work came.
Yes, that's right. So, John Nash was a star. By the time he walked, he arrived on a Princeton campus at 19. He was, first of all, he looked like a star. He was very good looking. He was tall. He was striking. For a mathematician, he was very well dressed and had excellent Southern manners. And people's eyes were always on him. That's what made it possible for me as a reporter to reconstruct his story, because he was so striking to people that at every stage of his life, people followed him and had memories of him. That's not true of most people, but it was true of him, and he remained a star.
And always
until the end of his life.
Yeah, and always on his own angle. Here he is in a 2004 interview. This was posted to the Nobel Committee's website about John Nash talking about his outsider's approach to economics.
I don't think exactly like a professional economist. I think about economics somewhat like an outsider.
Somewhat like an outsider. Steve in Cumberland, Wisconsin. Steve, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Sylvia Nasser and Jörgen Weibel.
Well, thank you very much. I admire Professor Nash's work and have tried to apply it in my own career over the years. What I'm curious about, for those of you who might know him better than I, I've certainly read his work, but I have been striving to help people build a more cooperative society with housing cooperatives and daycare cooperatives and businesses, all the ways that you can apply the idea that we all do better if we work together instead of fighting each other. Did Professor Nash ever express a lament for the inability of human nature to see the truth of the Nash equilibrium?
Steve, let us pick it up. Jorgen Weibel, I'll bring that to you. We've also got a comment online here that may take us in the same direction, with a listener writing on our website saying one of the core principles of libertarians and unabashed advocates of capitalism is that competition is the greatest force in the universe. A listener writes, Nash's equilibrium helps show some flaws in these unfounded ideologies. What about competition, cooperation, human nature? How does Nash's game theory illuminate these for you?
I think this is a fantastic tool to analyze such questions, and they are eminently important. And I agree that cooperative solutions would be desirable by most measures, and most economists would agree with that. But John Nash was a very clear intellectual researcher who just set forth a very clear machinery to analyze things. And he got, you get the answers depending on how you set up the model, how you describe the situation and how you formalize it. So that is not a choice we have to say we would like to have more friendly solutions. I think that John, I never heard him complain about that, that the equilibria could be then socially very unfortunate. However, I think that most game theorists, and I think also John Nash, would say, well, that suggests we should change the rules of the game so that the equilibria that we get are useful and good for us. And this is the topic of mechanism design, which was awarded the Economics Nobel Memorial Prize in 2007 by Leonid Hurwitz, Eric Maskin, and Roger Myerson. Because what they did, they said exactly this. They put up this in this way. So suppose we have some goal, or somebody has a goal. It could be a company, it could be a country, it could be a government, it could be an agency. Now, suppose it can design rules in society, how competition can happen between firms, how you are supposed to bid in auctions, how you can behave in the streets without punishment and so on, right? Design rules and then analyze, given those rules, what would be the Nash equilibrium? What would people do? If they would do things in their best interest, and those best interests could be anything. They might be selfish, but they don't have to be selfish. They can have any goal functions. So that I think is a fantastic way to analyze this very important question, to take a machinery which is systematic, it is not biased in any direction, I would say, and then apply it and then say, okay, can we now design taxes, rules, regulations, if you like, laws in such a way that the resulting equilibria will be what we desire. That then was analyzed in a brilliant way by these three persons I mentioned, building on the shoulders of John Nash.
But in that, it's dependent upon rules that are laid down, not exactly law of the jungle. Was that Nash's presumption that...
Yeah, Nash's presumption is that there are a game is defined by its rules, right? So you say that the rules would say what you can do, right? And then if you violate the rules, you're punished. So that would be in game theoretic perspective. If you make something which is illegal, let's say, then you risk to become imprisoned or whatever. So a game consists of the rules and the information that people might get along the way as they play, and also the participants can have their goals. They can strive to win something or earn money or to help the environment, whatever they want. But the game is thought of as a bunch of rules, and then by choosing these rules carefully and analyzing what will most likely happen now if people behave in that situation with those rules in that society or in that environment, using Nash equilibrium would then be a very, very useful way to think about what can happen then. And then how should we then choose the rules? Should we, for example, have a carbon tax to reduce carbon emissions? What would be the equilibrium if we did that? how would it affect not only carbon emissions, but also other activities in society.
So Sylvia Nasser Nash did not say humans would act in these ways, these cooperative ways necessarily. He said they could act, I guess, in these ways if put into the right structure.
That's right. On a personal level, John Nash was a total individualist who, however, placed a very high value on family but generally went his own way, followed his own visions. He wasn't a do-gooder. He wasn't a joiner. He did once on one problem that he solved get a lot of other mathematicians to work on pieces of it. Again, they had no idea what the overall objective was or what he was getting at, but he did know how to get people to cooperate with him when it served a goal that he wanted to pursue. But he was an individualist, just to answer mm-hmm. your question. Mm-hmm.
Cynthia in Beaufort, South Carolina. Cynthia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I am a 68-year-old woman who has her PhD from Harvard in economics.
Uh-huh.
Very strong in mathematics, but I chose economics because it was a breeze. And I had the privilege of knowing John Nash while I was in Cambridge.
Wonderful.
And 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with bipolar. And my colleagues and my family have ostracized me due to the fact that I have a mental illness. And I'm totally functional and on my own.
Yes.
And I'd like to know how John Nash's family and friends helped him during his period of his illness.
We know they helped a lot, but exactly how they did it, Cynthia, your story rivets my attention. Sylvia Nasser, Cynthia would like to know how this worked. It hasn't worked, it sounds, right. In summary, quite as well right. for her.
Well, the mathematical community tried very, very hard when Nash first got sick to support him and to help him get better and to continue working on the problems that he was working on. Eventually, however, he alienated everyone and wound up alone in West Virginia, in Virginia living with his mother, and that is... You know, that's one of the tragedies of paranoid schizophrenia caused him to behave in ways that pushed other people away. But as we were talking before, Alicia took him back in and gave him a home for the next 25 years, and there were people. Mathematicians in Princeton, a very tiny handful, who continued to see the Nashes, but he became pretty isolated until he started to get better, and the Nobel Prize really was the reconnection with the community.
He was lucky for his brilliant wife, Alicia, there, I guess. Lucky, in a way, for Jürgen Wabel and those with the Nobel who came into his world. Cynthia, I hope there's some hope in that. And, of course, there's much more in Sylvia's book, A Beautiful Mind. Julia in Spokane, Washington. Julia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I am a licensed clinical social worker, actually, in Oregon. And I have spent my entire career working with mental health issues in a variety of settings. And currently, I'm working at a psychiatric facility.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great things, he contributed a great deal in regards to mathematics and economics. However, the movie, and I really want to thank Sylvia for writing the book, really gave us a little moment of insight into the possibilities of someone with schizophrenia. It is a terrible and life-altering disease. It is a disease, and it is treatable. And we get a picture from the media of people with schizophrenia as being, classified with terrorists and people who are prone to killing other people. And that is far, far from the truth. There's a rare exception, but there are rare exceptions of people killing people who are completely sane.
An inspiration in John Nash's case, and we see it with you, Julian. I appreciate your call. Our time is so short. Sylvia, very quickly, John Nash and Alicia Nash's son, Johnny, also schizophrenic. How is he now, and who is caring for him?
Well, I was at the funeral yesterday in Princeton. It was just for family and friends. And Johnny is in his early 50s. He's still very, very sick. His illness has proved to be intractable. And he lived with his parents. Oh. So their death was a special tragedy for him. Fortunately, Alicia was a member of a Catholic congregation in Princeton, and there is a group of parishioners who for a long time have been a support for the family and particularly for Johnny, and they are very involved right now. Alicia also had a cousin and a nephew who are helping to make arrangements for Johnny and see that he gets the support that he needs.
There's a mercy
again,
in that.
This community.
You know,
yes.
Sylvia, we're out of time right there, but we're so grateful to you. Sylvia Nasser, author of A Beautiful Mind, the biography of John Nash, and Jorgen Weibel at the Stockholm School of Economics, who was there early on with John Nash. Our great thanks to both of you for being with us today as we remember John and Alicia Nash. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.